This is the educational and business meeting of the Judicial Council of California for August 22, 2013. The meeting is now in session. This is the start, as you know, of a two-day session. We will adjourn this afternoon at approximately 4:10 p.m. and reconvene tomorrow morning, Friday, at 8:30. That's for the second part of our business meeting agenda. In addition to the council members present, we have Justice Miller, I believe Judge Brandlin, Judge Ellsworth, and Mr. Robinson either joining us now or will be joining us by teleconference. Are you there? Not yet.
Justice Miller's here.
Thank you. Thank you, Justice Miller and Judge Brandlin. And I advise you that at any time you care to speak, please just open up and speak up, because I know it's hard to participate by phone, and don't feel that you're stepping on our toes by jumping in. As always, at the start of every meeting, and as I will again tomorrow, I remind council members that our meetings are audiocast live with real-time captioning on our California Courts website, and portions of our meeting may be videotaped for later use on the California Courts website. And for the benefit of the online audience, and also for council members joining us by phone, please speak into your microphones and remember to address each other by name so that the listeners and real-time captioning readers can follow the discussion. I also want to welcome and acknowledge the new incoming Judicial Council and committee members joining us today. We won't put them to work just yet, and Judge Stout will be presenting in a different capacity tomorrow, but we will be benefiting from their knowledge and experience very soon. We welcome Judge Robert Glessman, Judge Rubin, Presiding Judge Dean Stout, Presiding Judge Brian Walsh, and Mr. Mark Bonino. Before we begin with item one, I would also like to acknowledge the positive working relationship and knowledge-sharing processes we have developed with our colleagues in the Department of Finance in recent years. It's helped our branches understand the state budget process, and I believe in their understanding of how our branch operates. We've also had a very positive collaboration on the trial court funding work group with Department of Finance, and I thank you, Mr. Cohen, for presenting us today as we continue this process of cooperation, collaboration, knowledge sharing, and education. I turn it over to Judge Jarre to introduce our educational speaker, Mr. Michael Cohen.
Thank you, Chief, and good afternoon, one and all. As the Chief mentioned, Michael Cohen, who will take office as Director of the Department of Finance on September 16, has graciously consented to provide us with some educational background regarding the department today and its activities, and stressed to me in advance when he kindly spent some time with me in his office a couple of days ago that he'd very much like to entertain questions from you as well during that process. Presently, Mr. Cohen serves as Chief Deputy Director of the Department of Finance for Governor Brown, and in this capacity advises the governor on the state budget and serves as the department's lead contact with the legislature. From 1997 to 2010, Mr. Cohen worked at the Legislative Analyst's Office, most recently serving as Deputy Legislative Analyst, advising the legislature on a wide range of matters pertaining to state government, including the state's overall budget situation. He previously served as the LAO's Director of State Administration and as a local government finance analyst. Mr. Cohen earned his master's degree in public affairs from the Lyndon B. Johnson School at the University of Texas and his bachelor's degree in urban studies from Stanford. Once again, Mr. Cohen, thank you so very much for taking the time to be with us today. Please.
Thank you, Chief and Judge Jarre, and all of you for having me. I, as the Chief said, I very much look forward to continuing the collaboration and cooperation that we've tried to develop over the last few years, and I obviously see room for improvement and more discussion in the coming years, and I look forward to that. What I've got in terms of a prepared presentation for you is just a few slides that give the broadest brushes of the Department of Finance and the budget process. I thought I'd work through those just to give everyone a little bit of grounding on what it is my department does, and then I am happy to start the conversation in terms of your budget and whatever questions you have about the budget process. We're in a particularly good time here in terms of starting a conversation, as you know, we just finished this year's budget and just starting to ramp up on the preparations for next year's budget. So with that, just to run through some of the key things that the Department of Finance does. I know most people, the judicial branch as well as in the general public, see the Department of Finance as the budget office, which is certainly accurate and takes a large percentage of our time, but we do have a wide variety of roles. First and foremost is we're there to serve the governor as his fiscal policy advisor, so anything the governor needs is going to be our number one priority. Preparing the budget, and that's what I'll talk about more over the next few minutes, clearly a key responsibility and what takes up much of our time. We also, though, when we're not working on preparing a budget, we're providing fiscal oversight on the budget that was just enacted. So part of our responsibilities is to ensure all of the money that's been appropriated by the legislature is used in the way it was intended and that departments are following all of the state laws and regulations and policies to make sure that the citizens and residents of California are getting the best bang for their buck from their tax dollars. Audits and program evaluation. We have a unit within the Department of Finance that's available for specific targeted audits and program reviews. So when we discover a problem area, this is our go-to team in order to figure out what went wrong and how to do it better. So in the last couple years, good example with the Department of Parks and Recreation, in terms of their problems with not disclosing money, our auditors were able to go in and figure out what happened and lay out for us and the governor and the legislature what steps we should take in order to make sure things like that don't happen again. Our demographic and population research unit, we are, in essence, the state's demographer. And so on our website, periodically, we publish our population projections, both on a statewide total as well as county by county. The demographic trends are clearly an important part of where the state's going. And so those are the folks that I rely on to sort of highlight what's coming next in terms of the state's population growth and demographic changes. Infrastructure planning, the Department of Finance is charged in state law with sort of being the overall convener of all of the different departments within state governments, various capital outlay and five-year plans, figuring out both what are the critical needs in terms of construction, but then one of the areas that we're increasingly interested in is how do we maintain those physical assets that we already have. Our accounting system, we provide sort of consulting services to those state departments that use the statewide accounting system, and that's obviously a key piece of then linking to our budget systems. In the coming years, we are working to integrate both our budgeting and our accounting systems in a single information technology system known as FISCAL. And so that's one of the things that we're working hard on is to have a much more modern IT system that can provide information on a real-time basis rather than needing a lot of individual effort to pull what should be pretty straightforward data. And then the last thing on the slide, redevelopment agency dissolution. This is a new responsibility that we've picked up over the last couple years. As redevelopment agencies shut down at the local level, there's obviously a lot of complicated unwinding of financial arrangements, and we now have a unit that's charged with serving as the statewide entity to oversee that dissolution, making sure that all the rules are followed so that the billions of dollars get back to core local services. So dollars are going back to cities, counties, special districts, as well as to the state to help pay for education financing. So this next slide covers the revenue side of our state budget. So where does the money come from? And generally when you hear about the state budget, people are talking about the state general fund. That's our biggest fund and the fund that the legislature can decide where the money goes. There are numerous special funds and bond funds that provide additional revenues, but by definition, those are more restricted in their use. So the general fund this year, $97.1 billion worth of revenues expected. And as you can see, the personal income tax is by far our largest revenue source, and that's been growing over time. As we have, as you well know, a progressive income tax system in the state. So as wealth has become more concentrated in the state, it's been taxed at the highest marginal tax rate, and that's sort of pushed a greater share of our state revenues into the personal income tax. In contrast, the sales and use tax has been a shrinking share of the state budget. That's been caused by both a shift to the purchasing of services rather than taxable goods, as well as the relative price of those taxable goods compared to the other spending that's going on in the economy. So over the last 40 years or so, we have seen sort of a shrinking of the red piece of the pie for the sales tax and a growth in the blue piece with the personal income tax. And that certainly has made our state budgeting more challenging, particularly starting with the internet.com boom 1999-2000. We've seen an increasing development of personal income tax revenues coming from capital gains and other investment income. And that income has proven to be extremely volatile, very much tied to the stock market, and so that's made figuring out how much money we're going to have this year and next year increasingly challenging for the revenue forecasters that are on staff. So to talk just a little bit so you have a sense of the things we look at when we try to figure out how much state revenues we're going to have this year, next year, and into the future. It's obviously critically important that our forecasters get as close to accurate as possible. When we're too high in our revenue forecast, it makes us come back and, you know, do mid-year cuts or other actions to try to correct and bring our spending down. If we're too low in our revenue forecast, then we've sort of denied the legislature and the governor the opportunity to decide where to make key investments through the state budget. So we're always trying to be as accurate as possible. That being said, I'll tell you right now, our revenue forecast for this year's budget is wrong. The one we'll put out for next year's budget will be wrong, and they will be wrong for all time. It's just we will see if we're too high, too low. And our goal when we put together a revenue forecast is to always think there's a 50% chance we're too high and a 50% chance we're too low. So we're always trying to find that perfect spot where it could go, you know, to the good or to the bad of equal probability. But that being said, if we knew exactly where that spot was, we would also have nailed our revenue forecast. So our folks do their absolute best. They're well trained and well experienced. But you see all of the different factors here under economic outlook. of the types of things that they're trying to forecast. So for each of the individual taxes, we have a model that pulls in various factors. The national economic outlook, the gross domestic product is a big driver, but you've also got employment trends, inflation, where we think the stock market's going to be, corporate profits, the housing market. All of these individual factors go into our revenue forecast, and if any of you invest your own money, you know, just the stock market itself is impossible to predict. And so when that's such a key factor on determining how much capital gains and investment income we're going to have, and there's no ability to forecast it, you can immediately tell that it's a challenge. And we're doing we do the best we can, but if we're 99% right, we're still going to be about $1 billion off in our forecast. And so, you know, small changes can lead to big dollar swings, and that's part of my everyday challenge is to figure out how we can get better and how we can get closer to accurate. So those are all sort of the classic forecasting parameters. But then you also have the federal government coming in with law changes that affect our tax payments, and of course the states similarly making policy changes. And over the last 5-6 years, we've had more of these changes than certainly is historically the case in terms of their magnitude and importance. And just recently, we had federal tax changes so that beginning on January 1st, 2013, income tax rates went up. People knew that was coming. And so we know for sure that some people, those that could, accelerated their income and their stock market sales into the end of 2012. But exactly how much they accelerated is sort of been our big question. And so 2012-13 that just finished was a very good revenue year. We know much of that higher revenue was from the acceleration of capital gains from calendar year 2013 into 2012. But we don't know exactly what percentage. We forecast in the budget that it was about 25%, but again, it's one of those things where you don't know for sure, but it's very critical because the assumption you make on a key piece like that affects how much you think is sort of a one-time factor versus your base revenue forecast, and all of those things build on each other as you put a revenue forecast together. Just like the federal government, the states made a lot of revenue changes over the last number of years. As you well know, we have Proposition 30 and Proposition 39 going into effect this year that add new tax revenues to the mix. As we put the budget together, we were trying to figure out when people would make those payments, since we don't have a trend line for knowing what month they would make the payments. It makes forecasting a little bit more difficult. And then some of the policy changes made at the start of the recession back in 2008-2009 were designed to accelerate revenues from an upcoming year into the current fiscal year. And that basically, in terms of estimated payments and withholding, it completely undid all of our historical records in terms of knowing, well, what percentage of a person's tax returns will they pay in the four estimated time periods as well as the settle up in April. So all of our monthly cash data sort of was garbled in terms of once we factored in all of the policy changes, the figuring out what a month's cash meant in terms of an overall annual budget forecast became more and more complicated. And so every month, both the controller's office and our office put out a bulletin in terms of how much we received the last month, and we compare that to what was forecast. But as I said, forecasting just an annual budget number is hard enough. Figuring out what month we expect that to come in is an even more complicated thing. And you layer on that the state's accrual rules in terms of which fiscal year revenue is allocated to. You can't always tell what's going on from a month's revenue. And so I bring that up just to really kind of as a cautionary note that you'll see these monthly reports in terms of where the state's revenues are going, and certainly 1 month's data does not make a trend. And so we really focus on our January and our May revenue forecasts as the time where we're able to take all the information together and get a fresh look on our revenue forecast. So the revenues are obviously one side of our budget. The other side is our spending. And so this fiscal year, the general fund is expected to spend $96.3 billion. And this pie chart kind of splits up where those dollars will go. You can see by far the biggest piece of the pie is Proposition 98. That's the constitutional funding formula for K-12 schools as well as community colleges. Higher education combined with K-14 education makes up roughly half of the budget. Then you bring in health and social services that make up almost a third of the remaining budget. Our retirement obligations that you see in PERS and STERS and retiree health, about 5%. Debt service, just over another 5%. Corrections, 9%. And then, as you see, the judiciary's budget is there at 1.5%. And each of these different sections of the pie have very different funding circumstances and rules that go with them. Many of those rules make budgeting more complicated. It's certainly much more complicated than it was 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, it was dramatically more complicated than it was 50 years ago. Proposition 98's formula is probably what gets the most attention in terms of how much is required to be allocated to schools is driven by a variety of factors, largely building on the prior year's amount and then taking into account how the state's personal income is growing, how our state revenues are growing, how many school kids are showing up at our public schools. Similarly, in say the health area, much of our health programs are sort of a joint partnership with the federal government. But being the higher level of government, the federal government gets to make the rules, and so they have been a very key factor in terms of as we've gone through these difficult budget years the last 5-6 years, telling us what we could change and what we couldn't change. And many times over the last 5 years, it's been frustrating because we've wanted to go a certain direction only to find out that the federal government or the federal courts have said no, not allowable under federal law. And so that's sort of cut off many of our options. Higher education and the judicial branch, I think, have been similar in terms of clearly the general fund for both of those areas has been significantly reduced since the Great Recession began. Part of the reason for that has been the ability to substitute alternative revenue sources. So in your case, increased fees, sometimes moving money over from your construction funds, those types of things where other program areas don't necessarily have the same options. Higher education, the tool's largely been increasing student tuition so that we've cut the general fund significantly and made it up on raising student fees and tuition. But just as the case in the judicial branch, all of those actions in higher education have an effect where you end up with, say, the middle class getting squeezed with higher debt loads than historically has been the case, or people not being able to you know, continue their educational dreams. So all of these areas have their own intricacies, and putting together an annual budget really is sort of within the parameters of state law, the Constitution, federal law, federal regulators, figuring out how all the pieces fit together, sometimes figuring out what pieces you can change rather than continuing to go by the old rules. But that being said, there's lots of intricacies and complications. So I wanted to just sort of walk you through the budget timeline to give you a sense of what it is finance is working on. I'm sure you've seen pieces of the budget process, but to give you kind of the full year flavor. So right now, departments are working on submitting budget change proposals. Basically, a budget change proposal is just we want to either add money or subtract money from our budget. The state budget generally is an incremental budget that the assumption is you're going to get what you got last year, and then you come to the governor and the legislature and ask to make any changes to that. So there's a budget policy letter that the director of finance puts out each summer. I noticed that's in your packet for tomorrow when you talk about your own budget requests that you're looking to submit. The deadline is September 13th for Department of Finance to get all of these requests. This year's budget policy letter, very similar to past years, that while clearly we have turned the corner and have our budget in balance, it's very narrowly balanced, and so we're only looking for those requests that are meet the strict guidelines of the letter in terms of being the absolute most critical needs, requesting that departments find efficiencies to deal with rising costs rather than adding additional money, and those types of things. So during the fall, post September 13th, my staff works through all of those requests, evaluating them for their compliance with the parameters that we've laid out, as well as making sure, you know, things as simple as the numbers adding up, and that to more complicated questions of is this sort of the most critical need? Can these costs be absorbed? Are there other ways to accomplish whatever the goal is of the budget request? Those are the types of questions that our analysts are trained to ask. In addition, we're updating all of what's known as caseload in terms of our health and social service programs. So how many people are using the state's Medi-Cal health program? Once we know how many are using it now, how many do we think are going to be using it in the upcoming year? All of those types of caseload adjustments are made to try to forecast basically what on our existing program and under existing law, what do we think all of our programs are going to cost? At the same time, we have all of our revenue forecasters working through the different sort of factors that I laid out a few slides ago and trying to come up with a new revenue forecast for both the current fiscal year and the upcoming budget year that starts July 1. And that's basically we take what we think under current law all of our spending will be, and under current law what our revenues would look like, and we match them up. And the goal and the expectation is that they're going to be roughly equal, so that we're not spending more money than we have. Obviously, over the last number of years, that hasn't been the case. And when we've matched them up, when Governor Brown took office, basically the spending was about $20 billion higher than the revenues we were expecting. So when you heard people talk about a $20 billion structural budget deficit, that was basically these two forecasts coming together, and that every year into the future, we were basically seeing that if nothing was done, the state would spend $20 billion more than it was bringing in. Obviously untenable and absolutely horrible fiscal policy to continue that. And those are the changes that we've made over the last three budgets. And so now, based on our current revenue and spending projections that we adopted along with the state budget in June, those two lines are basically matching up, and so we're projected to be in balance for the foreseeable future. We forecast the budget year plus three additional years, and so in all four of those years, we expect spending to stay within expected revenues. So all of that leads up to the release of the governor's budget on January 10th by the governor. And then that kicks off the legislative process where the legislature holds dozens of hearings, basically vetting all of our proposals. In the spring, as that vetting is taking place, we're updating all of our various numbers. So the same process that we go through over about 3 months in the fall, we do in about a month in April to update everything, building up to the May revision that gets released May 14th. It is particularly challenging given that April is the single biggest revenue month that the state has. And obviously that's from personal income tax payments that we all make on or before April 15th. And so those payments basically come in, you know, right about that first week after April 15th, the bulk of it. And then our revenue forecasters have no more than probably about 10 days to figure out, well, how much money came in, how much were we expecting, why is it different, and knowing as much as we can in that short amount of time about why they're different, what do we think that means for the future? And so putting together the May revision is definitely, I would say, the most challenging couple of weeks for the Department of Finance. That in the fall, we have much more time to sort of deliberate and to have conversations back and forth and sort of review everything in great detail. And then we were basically doing it again in a very shortened window and trying to take into account all of the feedback we've gotten since January 10th, all of the new information we have, and putting together a budget that we can present to the legislature, and basically they have a month to get it enacted. And so when you take, you know, our 2 weeks or so when sort of crunch time putting the May revision together combined with their month, that's really the crunch time for budgeteers in putting together the that budget. June 15th, legislature is constitutionally required to pass the budget, and the fiscal year starts on July 1st. Last slide, and then I'm excited to engage in some back and forth with questions and conversation, just to point out some key changes that have happened over the last number of years that have, I think, changed the way we do budgeting in California. And it for those of you who have been following the state budget for a number of years, you'll have noticed these changes sort of filtering in. For those of you who are newer to the state budget, these will just have become part of day-to-day business, but they are important. First, Proposition 25, passed by the voters in 2010, moved the budget vote from being two-thirds of each house of the legislature to majority vote, obviously requiring a majority instead of a supermajority makes it easier to pass, and a key factor in getting an on-time budget the last 3 years. Those of you who have been doing this for a while will remember that our budgets were stretching at times into October at the latest. Obviously, when you go you know, 2, 3, 4 months into the fiscal year before you've actually told everyone what their budget is for the fiscal year, makes it impossible to run the state from a fiscal management perspective, and impossible to expect a branch of government or individual state departments to get anything done that you would normally expect them to get done, because you're already so far into the fiscal year before you've kind of laid out what changes you expect to make. Second, multi-year budgeting. As I mentioned, we're now forecasting both the upcoming budget year as well as the next 3 years, and so we take into account any trends we're seeing, any law changes that are due to take effect in the next couple of years. This has been done informally for, say, the last decade or so, but it's now a state law that the Department of Finance do these forecasts, and we put them up on our website. And certainly this administration has been very dedicated to using those as a tool to our budgeting. So whereas in the past, multi-year budgeting was used to know that, well, we passed this year's budget, it's balanced. When we come back next year, we've got a $5 billion or a $7 billion shortfall we're going to have to deal with. This administration's made it a priority to know that when we pass the budget, it's not just this year's budget that's in balance, it's the upcoming 3 years as well. And so that when you hear the governor and the Department of Finance talk a lot about holding down ongoing spending, this is how we know that if we have ongoing spending increases, what it's going to do to our structural budget situation, how much we can afford, how much we can't afford. As you know, the Proposition 30 tax revenues are temporary, 7 years on the personal income tax, 4 years on the sales tax. So as we sort of get closer to the Proposition 30 revenues sunsetting, the multi-year budgeting will be a critical tool so that we're constantly adjusting to make sure that we're not going to wait until the last possible moment to bring our budget back into balance. Instead, we'll be able to take a longer-term view to gradually get there, use natural revenue growth as the bridge to make sure we stay in balance. And then finally, in 2011, the governor issued an executive order requiring my department to use more tools at our disposal to make sure we're getting the best bang for the buck out of tax dollars. So as I mentioned, traditionally the state budget is incremental budgeting. You get what you got last year, and then we make changes on the margin. Unfortunately, as you do that over the long haul, you end up losing track of what's in the base. You don't know sort of what's been funded. Lots of things that you might have funded that are now in the base, circumstances have changed. You might have given a department $10 million to address a problem that's been addressed, but it's been so long ago that people forgot that that's where the money was targeted. And so what we've done under this executive order is try to be more strategic about individual department budgets. So we're doing a lot of zero-based budgeting. Caltrans is a good example. So our Department of Transportation, we're in year two now of a four-year zero-based budgeting practice. So we're going sort of program area by program area to review what are the resources in a particular program and what should they be. And so in some cases, we're reviewing it, coming up and going, yeah, they're underfunded for what the expectation is of the department, and so we've put more resources into those program areas. In others, we've seen that they're sort of over-resourced for the expectations, that maybe the program requirements have expired. Their duties were to create a guidebook. The guidebook's been created, so they don't need the resources anymore. So zero-based budgeting is a tool we're using quite a bit, but we're also sort of using all the available tools to us. So we've got, as I mentioned, our auditors who can go in and do audits and program reviews. In some cases, performance measures make a lot of sense. To give you an example, in our Department of Consumer Affairs, we have all the different boards and bureaus that regulate individual industries. So this year, for the first time in the budget, we've got performance measures of how long it's taking them to take an enforcement action, to license an application. So all of those things to provide better information to the governor and the legislature to sort of improve our management, figure out where are the areas that are doing great, those that need more attention, and that sort of lets us drill down more effectively than just relying on the old way of incremental budgeting and just sort of adding additional money when there's a new problem that comes up. Instead, we sort of take a more holistic view of what are the goals we're trying to accomplish and what's the best way to get there. And so that's kind of, I think, my final thought in terms of what I view kind of the Department of Finance's role. It's really in the world of problem solving that there's no lack of problems that state government needs to tackle, and our job is to dive in there and figure out what's the best solution at the best price and give the governor that advice and recommendations and work with the legislature to make it happen. So, as I said, I very much look forward to working with you this upcoming year and into the future, and I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you, Michael. We've appreciated this, and I think we have some questions for you. Justice Holt.
Yes, thank you, Chief. Thank you, Mr. Cohen, for joining us this afternoon. I noticed in your first slide one of the key roles of the Department of Finance that you set forth was the demographic population research and projections, and I was just curious as to how that bears, if at all, on the budgeting process. Is it for your multi-year budgeting effort, or is it for current year budgeting? And I don't understand the connection.
Sure. It's for both. So we use our demographic projections to say, figure out what we think the number of households in poverty are going to be. And by once we have a projection of that, we're able to forecast how much we think caseloads are going to grow in those programs that serve the poor. So if we're seeing increased population generally and also increased households in poverty, we would expect our Medi-Cal program, our CalWORKs program, to see increased applicants. And so we'll build those both into the upcoming budget, but also as a way of figuring out, do we think over the next 4 years is sort of our CalWORKs, our welfare program, are we going to expect to see increased applicants or decreased applicants? We're going to team that general population growth information with what's going on with policy changes in welfare, as well as obviously unemployment is a key factor there. So you know, as unemployment comes down, we expect less enrollees in a program. When we were seeing unemployment go up, we were building in higher expected costs in those programs.
Thank you. The thing that generated the question really was, does shifts in population within the state and within the counties in the state, does that have any immediate bearing on the budgeting process?
Shifts sort of from one county to another, generally not. There may be some trends that we would see over the long term in terms of where the economic growth is going to be, what type of employment changes we see coming. But for the most part, we're budgeting sort of on a statewide level. And then once you budget a program on a statewide level, then there's definitely allocation decisions within those dollars that go to counties in terms of allocating the money and spending the money. And so we'll tend to forecast a program at the state level, say it's going to be $1 billion, and then within that, if there's population shifts within a county, County A, if they're shrinking in population, will see less of that $1 billion than they did the year before.
I see. Interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Justice Hull. Justice Baxter, then Judge Rosenberg.
Yeah. I want to also thank you, Mr. Cohen. I found it very interesting and enlightening. My question is whether or not the Department of Finance has any particular policy or practice that recognizes the distinction between agencies and departments of government as opposed to separate branches of government. And I'm referring to the legislature's budget, and I'm referring to the judicial budget. And my question really is there ever any special opportunity given to the leadership of these separate branches of government to make the case to the governor, to the Department of Finance, as to increasing the amounts for the to be included in the governor's budget at the beginning or even at the May revise?
Sure. There's obviously a level of respect and deference given to the legislature and the judicial branch that is very different than a department who works for the governor. That kind of is throughout our budgeting process that there is, I would say, a greater deference given at the same time that the governor is basically charged in signing a budget, sort of acting as, in the role of appropriating funds. But to the second part of your question, in terms of making an appeal or having access to a conversation, that I can guarantee you is available to the judicial branch. To if you ever feel that you have a perspective or information that's not sort of in our hands, then I don't think that's acceptable. You should always have the ability to engage us in a back and forth, provide us your insights, your information, your perspective. That without question is available to you.
I think historically, at least my understanding is that at least during better economic times, the governor's budget would simply include the amount submitted by the judicial branch for the, and that became part of the initial budget for the governor. Of course, times are more difficult right now. Hopefully, we've turned that corner, and assuming that corner has been turned, do you envision a return to the practice of the past where, based on the separation of powers and co-equal branch of government, the governor would accept the budget submitted by the judicial branch as that portion of the governor's budget?
In terms of would the governor just sort of pass along your budget to the legislature, that's obviously his call. But to be quite honest, I wouldn't recommend it. That part of his responsibility in proposing a budget is to review the budget of the judicial branch, and so it's certainly his prerogative to pass it on. But from a budgeting perspective, I think it makes sense for my department to review it, make recommendations for any changes, and so. I would expect that to continue, but that's not to say, again, to my earlier comments, that there shouldn't be a conversation about what my recommendations and my department's recommendations are to the governor, and if you feel that we're kind of missing why you submitted what you did.
Thank you.
Judge Rosenberg, then David Yamasaki, then Judge O'Malley.
First of all, Mr. Cohen, I want to join the Chief and others in saying thank you for being here and reaching out to the branch, having this dialogue. It's very much appreciated.
I am a trial court judge. I used to be a presiding judge for three terms, and I was chair of the presiding judge advisory committee for a while. So my perspective is from the trial courts. And we had a very brief conversation before we started. I really do feel that Mr. Cohen has a good understanding of the unique nature of this branch and of trial courts. My question has two parts. First of all, trial courts are really unique in California because they flowed from the counties to the state, so you've got 58 different trial courts that are independent and have to operate their own budgets, if you will. They have to be responsible for their own cash flow and payroll and all the things that a court has to take care of. Our single greatest concern is not having sufficient funds for cash flow. Now, we're not talking about more money, per se. We're just talking about paying the bills because we are in that unique category of having to write the checks to pay the salaries and et cetera. So I think from the trial court's perspective, our greatest concern is that without a reasonable reserve, we're not going to be able to pay the bills, and we're literally going to have to shut courts down. So that's my first question. What are we going to do about that?
Sure. Thank you for the question. I agree with you that trial courts are kind of a unique entity in the state, and certainly we have no interest in creating a situation where courts can't pay their bills within a set budget. You know, if you're talking cash flow, we did, my staff engaged with yours this year in terms of proposing legislation that was adopted as part of the budget to help on the cash flow side of things. And we're certainly, as the reserve policy continues to be implemented, if there's other things, other tools that are necessary that come to light, I'm committed to working on those and making sure that bills can be paid on time. So I do think the cash becomes intertwined with the budget, obviously, that within a set dollar amount, it may be that you're not able to spend as much money as you would like. That's the nature of budgeting. But once you figure out your year's worth of expenses within the dollars that you're given, you should be, and it is critical that you're able to meet the cash flow demands that in terms of what month those expenses pay. And so as we continue down the road of implementing the reserve policy, anything on that cash flow side, we're very open to continuing to make any changes. So
thank you.
Sure.
The only other thing I wanted to mention, I primarily do criminal cases, and that is really a substantial, maybe the largest segment of our work in the trial courts. The biggest single problem we see on the street is drugs. Drugs seem to wind up being about 75% of the crimes we see. Drugs are somehow involved, either directly or indirectly. And I just wanted to put a plug in for smart programs that pay for good drug treatment. Every study I've seen shows that for every dollar we spend on that, we save at least $3 at the other end in terms of keeping people out of prisons and restoring them back into society. So I think we have to not only be budget-wise but smart in our expenditures. Just a little plug for that.
Thank you. David Yamasaki, Judge O'Malley, then Judge D'Alba.
Thank you, Chief, and thank you, too, Mr. Cohen, for meeting with us today. I'm the Court Executive Officer for the Superior Court in Santa Clara County, and first off, wanted to extend our appreciation on behalf of our court and our residents for your support in the construction of our courthouse, to which we hope to break ground in a couple of weeks. It means a lot to us and certainly the community that we're going to be serving. My question is relates to perhaps your background. If you can share with us to what degree you anticipate considering in your recommendations information reported by the Legislative Analyst's Office.
Sure. So as you heard in my bio, I spent basically the first 13 years of my professional career there. I started on the local government assignment where I did we sort of treated the court assignment as under our criminal justice unit, but I had opportunities as sort of the unique sort of at that point it was transitioning from the local court system to a state-funded system, had opportunities there, and I think, you know, the analyst's office is clearly sort of molded how I think about state budgeting and state issues, and so I take their reports very seriously. I read all of them. That's not to say that I agree with all of them. Sometimes I didn't even when I was there. I didn't agree with the conclusions. There's times where there's just sort of people weigh different factors in building a recommendation, and I would be putting more emphasis on one thing over another, and so would have gotten to a different conclusion. And then now in my current role, clearly I have a lot more factors weighing on particular policy areas. You know, the analyst office has the luxury and the benefit of only caring about what they think and not taking into consideration actually getting the votes for a budget, implementing the governor's policy priorities. So while I will take into consideration everything they write and recommend, I certainly have no expectation that the governor's budget is going to sort of be 100% reflection of what the LAO would recommend.
Thank you. Judge O'Malley and then Judge D'Alba.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen, again for being with us this afternoon, and congratulations.
Thanks.
I hope you feel that way.
Yeah, I do.
Hope you feel that way in 6 months or a year. So a couple of things. You know, we had the recent change in the law that now allows us to collect for the Internet sales, things on the Internet and so forth. And so the first question is, to what degree do you think is that going to be a substantial help to us? Or as far as, you know, the folks in your office that are kind of trying to guesstimate, you know, how that might affect us, is that something that we can look forward to in a positive way, or do you think, you know, it really would have minimal effect?
Sure, and it's a great question to give me a chance to kind of use an example on how we build these things in. So basically when we were doing our multi-year revenue forecast before the law actually went into effect, so it passed 1 year, but then it wasn't going into effect until about a year later. You know, we didn't show any revenues in the first year, but then we did build them in the subsequent year, and then going forward. And we built in the exact number is escaping me right now. It was something in the neighborhood of $150 million annually, and reports from the Board of the Equalization were giving us comfort that we were in the right ballpark. I think they're a little bit lower than that now, and we'd constantly be sort of adjusting them. But that kind of gives you a perspective of you're talking about, you know, somewhere in the $100 to $200 million range in the $100 billion budget. So clearly, as a budgeteer, I'll take every $1,000 and $100 million is a lot of money, but it's not going to sort of swing the fortunes of the state in and of itself. That said, you know, the change has brought Amazon into the state with distribution centers. All of the employment that comes from that is a very positive thing, and that would also build into our economic forecast. So, but all of our numbers now, when you see them, will have basically built in our expectation of those of those increased revenues. So it's really every time we go back and do a new budget forecast, we're looking for changes. What's changed since the last forecast? And so we're kind of re-engineering things to sort of adjust to the newest information. But something like that, it's just going to be on, very much on the margin. Is it $120 million or $130 million kind of change at this point going forward?
Of course, I'm doing my best to help out in that regard.
Thank you. Every book counts.
Yeah, exactly. Just don't tell my husband, will you? Okay, so then the second one is also, I'm a trial court judge. I also was a presiding judge, and I also was the chair of the presiding court judges across the state. And again, just to take it a little one step farther with Judge Rosenberg's concern about the reserves, you know, it's in addition to the cash flow, you know, of funds that we don't receive for 9 months, you know, and that sort of thing, and we have to put the money up front. That makes it really difficult for a court without any reserve. But in addition, you know, my question to you is, so we don't have the money to maybe pay for operation expenditures, such as a breakdown of a phone system or a breakdown of a computer system and things like that, where we would have a reserve to be able to pay for that or even improve it and upgrade it to be able to make it better and more efficient and then cheaper in the long run, as opposed to asking you for a lot of BCPs, mm-hmm. which I don't think is helpful for you or that you would want, and probably not a great business practice if we can, in our own way, more economically look to something that is something that we can afford and would benefit our court. So kind of your general feeling mm-hmm. about, you know, is that something the courts could possibly look to in the future to be able to do that? Or are we really going to be looking at a BCP type of procedure that you don't want and we don't want?
Thank you. It's, clearly the reserve policy change was influenced by our budget situation in terms of that you had dollars and we needed dollars, but. More than that, though, it was, I think, a philosophical issue for the administration in terms of continuing trial court funding and moving to more a state-funded system. And so we view the reserve policy as really a shift from local reserves to a statewide reserve that you, this body, will control. And that, so if a phone system unexpectedly breaks and another county has a sewer problem and a, you know, whatever the sort of emergencies and unexpected costs are, we wanted to sort of see those things weighed against each other at a statewide basis for the judicial branch and this council to be the one to sort of weigh those. So, it obviously is then a question of, well, how big is the reserve at the statewide level, and how big is the overall budget, so that, you know, if your individual trial court's budget is larger, then you might not ever need a reserve from a state, because you'll already have enough money to upgrade your phone system. So that's obviously...
Will I be alive in that? Will I live to see that day?
We're getting there. We're certainly on much more sound footing than we've been in any recent year. I can argue that we're in better fiscal shape than we have been since, say, 1999 or 2000. So,
and I guess I should clarify, you know, we don't want it to be an emergency. I can't afford to have my phone system break.
Right.
But I know it's old, and I know it needs to be replaced, type that sort of expenditure.
And so those are the things, as, you know, we don't at the Department of Finance want to get into 58 phone system reviews and going, oh, well, there's, you know, was built in 1980 versus 84, and, you know, it's time for, so we have no interest in getting down to that granular level. And so I think it'll be up at a broader level in terms of how much the judicial branch should have as a whole, and then really leave it to you as a body to figure out sort of more of the allocation at that granular level.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cohen. We've kept you over your time, but we have one more question from Judge D'Alba, sure. Then we'll conclude.
Thank you, Chief. And mine is a follow-up of sorts to Justice Baxter's first question. He asked, if I recall, if there was a policy or practice within your office with respect to our branch and examining our budget or budget change proposals. And I wrote down that your words were that you look at our request, our budget, with respect and deference. Your example of how you look at Caltrans and consumer services agencies and the like is illuminating. And my question is, does our branch enjoy any priority or sensitivity, for example, with respect to a budget change proposal? Or is it examined in the same way as Caltrans budget change proposals? And related, does the legislature submit budget change proposals to your office, and how are they looked at?
Sure. Ultimately, in terms of priorities and where any new dollars go, that's the governor's call. I work for the governor, and his priorities are my priorities in terms of where dollars go. For the legislature, they would comment that the voters cut their budget by about 40% with Proposition 140, and then gave a formulaic maximum that they can receive each year, building from that lower base. But that said, the governor in recent years has not included any increase in the legislature's budget in his proposals. So there is a similar review in terms of the request, and that it's not the legislature gave us this number, and so we'll plug it in. The legislature's budget is going through a similar process, but obviously the judicial branch has a lot more operations than the legislature. Their whole budget is about $200 million, and they're not kind of in 58 counties administering programs, and so it's not exactly the same type of review, but we are still reviewing the legislature's budget.
So, Mr. Cohen, thank you. So, Mr. Cohen, we look forward to being one of your first contacts on September 16th, and we wish you well. But we are very grateful that you came and spent the time with the overview and answered our questions. We look forward to a long and healthy relationship.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you.
We'll stand in recess for about 15 minutes. We come back at that.